And although we have seen distress in the system, it has been very minimal and it's now building. And you've seen several markets who have turned from what I would call motivated to distress. But we're now going to get to the point where the distress can be seen on a national level. And, so Q4 is really setting up to be ugly. And then Q1 is when really any of those FHA borrowers will be completely out of options if they cannot make those payments. And so that's when you're going to have a really material set of default. At the same time, you'll be entering into kind of the season again in Q1. So, the rest of the year just doesn't look good from here.
Melody Wright, good morning to you. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
Doing good. I'm very grateful that you came on. As I was saying briefly off camera, I last had you on. It was last winterish, and you gave a lot of warnings that stuff was hitting the fan in the spring, or just really right then. I wanted to say it was in February time as I was doing some due diligence for this talk. Let's just start with that. What has hit the fan? Get us up to speed, and is it continually hitting the fan?
Yeah, it's kind of one of these things where everybody wants one thing to point to, but there's so many things going on in the housing market. And what we were specifically talking about is that we knew that the guardrails had gone on the loss mitigation programs for FHA, which is basically government subprime. It's about 13% of the market. It is over 13% delinquent right now, but they've
Good
had all
gosh.
these very generous programs. Where you could just keep going back and say, please help me, please help me, and unfortunately, it's a lot of times these are investors that are illegally using these programs. So it's not like Joe and Jane couple lost their, it's investors who are just trying to get cheap leverage. But anyway, so the guardrails went on where now if you're in one of these programs, you have to make trial payments, you have to prove you actually can take this plan. And they're failing at about a 50% rate. Yeah.
Oh gosh, I'm not laughing at you. I'm just
No,
like the
I know.
severity of it.
It is, I think the most insane thing is for me to be on this side of it and no one is screaming from the rooftops except for me. Because I mean, the delinquency this much, this bad would have had everybody's hair on fire last time, but no. It's just being ignored. And so what we knew was going to happen is those delinquencies would slowly just keep kind of consolidating, get, the foreclosures were going to increase from basically last fall, not at some, a quick speed, because you even if you fail out of this program, you still might have some forbearance left. Believe it or not, it's insane. But from here, we are going to see delinquencies tick up. And now the concerning thing is that it had been pretty much isolated to the FHA portfolio, which is again government subprime. But what we've been noticing this season, so delinquency has a season, and that season usually peaks in December when you're spending too much money that you don't have for Christmas, you're shuffling things around, maybe you don't pay your mortgage, whatever. But then you get your tax refund, you get your bonus, and you get caught up. Well, what we're seeing in mortgage, as we're seeing very high delinquencies in credit cards and auto, mortgage had been like this because of all the intervention, but we're now seeing early stage delinquency. And this is important, Andy, because in the United States, we are obsessed with our credit scores. They pretty much are like our mark of the beast, kind of like this is our number, like where I'm a 750, I'm an 850, and so once you make that choice, especially as a prime borrower, and that's what Fannie and Freddie is, they're prime borrowers. They had credit scores often in the 700s, 800s. We're now seeing early stage delinquency out of season. And a lot of people think subprime is what drove the foreclosure crisis last. It's not. The actual foreclosure crisis came once people started losing their jobs. Think about all those Spirit employees. Think about all the layoffs that we have been hearing about. And of course, a lot of them got severance. I'm not saying Spirit specifically, but just generally. But these are now starting to flow through the system. At the same time, the Wall Street Journal just did an article over the weekend about just the increases in property tax, insurance, electricity, replacement costs. And I find it very funny to look at these articles now, Andy, because the same people writing them were the same people celebrating and refusing to challenge this run-up in home prices and refusing to see what was going to happen if that mania didn't stop. And so it's interesting to see these authored now because it was so inevitable. And anyone who was paying attention back in 22 and 23 would have seen this coming from, 100 miles away. But it just takes a long time, much longer than anyone ever believes. But housing moves at the speed of, think of the Titanic turning. It is a very slow process. So housing
Yeah,
market's
sorry.
frozen again, fourth year in a row. Rates have not come down, but go ahead, you ask your question.
Well, okay, so talk a little bit about seasonality. And again, I'm asking just really this for all of my viewers and listeners. What exactly is the seasonality and how important is that? And what happens when that's over? Is it just even worse, if that makes sense?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. So the season is the big deal in housing. And that's gonna, it'll get started, in the spring. It'll peak typically in June. That's when sales are supposed to peak. And then it kind of slows down from here. Now, last year, you have to remember we were coming out of the tariff terror, that really arrested all home sales. And so we had really pretty horrible stats last year, lowest sales since 1995. So we're seeing a little bit of an increase year over year in some places, the Northeast, no, the Midwest, no. But in the South and the West, where prices are coming down, we're seeing increases in sales. But your season, I mean, this is it. This is the last month. In 8 days, it's really the official end of the season. And then you kind of get this is where dynamics can get really kind of crazy because the reason you're always, even in 2008, you have seasonal firming of prices because the people that are transacting are the ones that can afford to, they're typically. You do have motivated selling and things like this, but it's not a lot of distress yet. Well, what's happening and will start to happen when those foreclosures increasing is you're going to get to the back half of the year. You're going to see people kind of peace out of the housing market, except for those that have to transact and except for those distressed sales. So that's going to pull a drag on to home prices. And although we have seen distress in the system, it has been very minimal and it's now building. And you've seen several markets who have turned from what I would call motivated to distress. But we're now going to get to the point where the distress can be seen on a national level. And, so Q4 is really setting up to be ugly. And then Q1 is when really any of those FHA borrowers will be completely out of options if they cannot make those payments. And so that's when you're going to have a really material set of default. At the same time, you'll be entering into kind of the season again in Q1. So, the rest of the year just doesn't look good from here. We've seen a lot of rage delisting where people just can't get the price they want. And so they're taking off the market because rates have been so stubborn. Even though they're down, through May of last year, rates averaged around 6.81%. This year it's about 6.23%. But really, I think everybody can see people can't get no. So there's plenty of people that could qualify, but it just doesn't make sense. And so until those rates get below six, you really don't see much more activity in the housing market. And we got below six for like 35 seconds. And then, we declared war and that was over.
You
So.
got it. So really my question is okay, when do sellers get really motivated? Yeah, what is your time frame on that? Because, and I'm just, this is very anecdotally, live here in Atlanta. I actually went to an open house out of curiosity more than anything. It was last weekend, not this, it was about a week ago. And beautiful home, they wanted $1 million for it, blah, 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 blah. And I was just thinking, there's no way they're going to get $1 million. And it was a beautiful home, but they're just not getting $1 million for this. But they didn't seem very motivated to sell. I guess Marissa, really my question is, when do you think that motivation is going to kick in? And then is it too late to sell?
Well, so yeah, it'll be too late, and it might already be too late, especially in Atlanta where you've had institutionals fire selling. Now, certain neighborhoods are just going to take longer. Those neighborhoods where there are million-dollar homes, where people are feeling good about the stock market and feeling like, hey, they can float this. So what you're going to see the distress, in the distressed areas first, meaning, Florida, Texas, where these, young buyers got in at the peak, unfortunately, and that just is crappy, but that's what's going to happen. For your million-dollar homes to start waking up to reality, it's going to be a couple of factors. It's going to be seeing a news article that says home prices have turned year over year negative. That will be a wake-up call. And then the big wake-up call likely for those million-dollar homes is going to be if we get a credit event or a correction in the stock market, which, I think there's a lot of good evidence through time that the land cycle is really what drives kind of the economy. And you typically are going to have that land real estate cycle turn over before the stock market correction. And so for you to be in a situation where you're, now they could have a specific situation where they're overlevered. And this is my favorite thing to do is when someone comes to you and says, hey, this guy's asking this crazy amount for this house. Like, what's the story? And I can go and I can look on county records and things like this. And I can see, oh, well, he's overleveraged. Like, he's underwater. And that just like having that kind of information changes the game. And then in these neighborhoods, Andy, of these million-dollar homes, I think you would probably be very shocked to see how many of them are underwater, how many of them have property tax liens, how many of them have property liens, owner liens. And so it's just, you've probably known these people. I certainly knew them in the last cycle. Until it's over, it's not over for them. It's just not. They don't give up. They don't give up until the bank comes and takes the keys out of their hand. I mean, that's just because they just, in many ways, a lot of these folks have had failures and easily gotten out of them because the government's been there to save them. I don't think that's coming in the same way, because a lot of this lending has been done by the non-banks. And if you think about why we have bailouts, it's because theoretically they're holding our deposits. That's why. Non-banks are not. And
Yeah.
so I don't think that it's going to go down the same way. But to your question is, sentiment has to change, but that has to be large scale awareness. And Atlanta is already in so much trouble as a market, Andy. I mean, you've got year over year price declines. You've got too much inventory. You've got underwater mortgages. You've got foreclosures. You've got auctions. Like, and Georgia is actually a very fast foreclosure state. They have a every month it's called Super Tuesday. They can go in 60 days, which is the fastest timeline in the country, Georgia and Texas. So it could happen faster than you think, but it could take longer to get there, if that makes sense to
No, it
you.
does. It makes a lot
Yeah.
of sense. I think it takes longer for psychology to change, but then
Yes.
once it does,
It
once you're
does.
in foreclosure, it goes really quick.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So.
So, what happens when, let's say, wave a magic wand? Well, I wouldn't even say major wave a magic wand, because I think the Fed, or I think they're just going to push down rates and do everything they can in the fall. That's just my own assumption, though. What happens then? Do we have too much distressed inventory, really, to, yeah, I mean, what happens then?
Well, they can do whatever they want. I mean,
Sure.
look, I'm watching the bond market right now, and they're just not having it. I mean, the bond market's just not having it.
Right.
You've got the 2-year at 4.2. We look like we might be about to invert on the yield curve, which is nuts.
Right.
And you're just seeing, and I mean, this is of all the things, it's really funny. I get the most feedback when I say I'm not sure rates are coming down on the long end of the curve. And people will fight me to the death on this. I'm like, look, I'm just telling you what I'm seeing. Like, I've read enough and studied this topic enough to know that I have no idea what's going to happen
Right.
because it is very, we are, it feels very much like things are changing from the last 40 years, right? But you can see every day that the 10-year is battling at the 4.4, 4.5 range. And so there is a battle right now to keep that thing below 4.5, but it has been completely impervious to what the Fed is doing. In fact, it often acts in the opposite direction if it's not. And so the Fed can do what it wants. The 10-year is who's in charge. And
Yeah.
right now they're large and in charge, and they've stayed, I mean, really tightly. It seems as if market movers are actually intervening on the long end of the curve to keep it lower. And so we'll see, but that's just the action I'm seeing right now. What could happen in the future, I don't know. But they tried to buy MBS, Andy, like they started buying MBS and not telling anybody over a year ago. Fannie and Freddie, not the Fed, to be clear, because the Fed, everyone knows that they bought MBS and made housing unaffordable, so that they can't do it. But Fannie and Freddie did it, not telling anybody. And then Trump announces that they're gonna do it, even though they had been doing it. And pretty much all those gains got erased. And so they've stopped buying the MBS. So the point to what you're saying is they can do a lot of things, just like they did a lot of things in 2009, a lot of things in 2010, a lot of things in 2011. I think you just get to a point in a cycle where there's nothing else you can do to arrest the decline. And I think that's where we are. The other thing they're trying to do is kind of a refi boomlet by using a new credit score called VantageScore. And this, every time I look at VantageScore versus, I'd say 9 times out of 10, VantageScore is way higher. So I think somebody that's got a 650 now looking like they've got a 750, the problem is that they're going to try that, but the debt burden is so large now, people will still not qualify for those refinances. So it's not going to be the saving grace that they hope it will be. Could it potentially slow things down? Maybe, if they can qualify.
Yeah. Well, we talked specifically about Atlanta, and that's where our, to all my viewers and listeners, that's where I'm from. But talk about just really nationwide in the sense of what are the hot spots, hot being negative, the biggest negative spots that you see? And is there any spot, is there any place in the country that's safe or a good place to hide out or that's not going to be affected as much as places like Atlanta or Florida or Texas?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of hot negative, I mean, poor Austin is just, and it has got so much further to go. They've got 26,000 apartments and homes for rent right now. Over 7,500 listed for sale. That does not include all the new homes. And I mean, what I saw there, so it's so funny when analysts are like, Austin's bottoming out. I'm like, you're out of your mind. So Texas, Florida, we know this. California is in a lot of trouble right now. You're seeing it everywhere except for San Fran, but I think that is probably a temporary boom, linked to, kind of the AI. Where to hide? Where one reason the Midwest has held up in terms of prices is because that's where everybody went to hide after 2022 and saw all the investors. They subscribed to Zelman. They all went to Ohio. They got in around the data centers, that kind of thing. But the best place to hide, I mean, is in one of the half-back states, if you have a, if you can work remotely or things like that. So like Tennessee, South Carolina, Alabama, but also know what you're signing up for. Living in the South is very, if you come from the Northeast, if you come from California, it's very, very different. But honestly, hide and rent right now, because you can go in any of these cities, like especially somewhere like Atlanta, and you'd be like, I want 3 months free. I want XYZ. I want this rent, and you're going to get what you want. So that would be my recommendation. As we are topping out here, some areas have totally topped, but there's still some that what you're seeing in the Northeast and Midwest where sales are down is just like this kind of floating in prices. They're not like going up like this. But you have so few transactions, the people that are transacting are the ones buying higher priced homes. And so it makes that median look, higher than it is, when in reality, you've got like hundreds of homes sitting in the same place with price cuts, but they can't move them. So is there a place to hide? Hide and rent is what I would say. But if you're looking for kind of your retiree home or, these states in the South, there's a lot you can get for your dollar. If you are willing to understand that you're making a big cultural, shift and change. And so, the housing market, if it's about shelter, but most people look at it as investment, and I think we have to get back to looking at it as shelter again. So my recommendation would be, the lower tax states and lower price states where things just didn't get too insane, but they got plenty insane around here where I am too. They're just going to come back to reality faster because we have no jobs here in the South. Like we really don't. So.
As this, it's interesting to me is just how much you had this, or it was all in the press that we have such unaffordable housing here, and yet when things are correcting and becoming more affordable, I mean, then everybody's bitching and whining because it's becoming more affordable, and it's obviously the homeowners and that sort of thing. It's just this doom loop cycle, and that's what we're going into.
And I mean, it kind of is yucky, this boomer versus all the rest of us fights that you're seeing out there. But at the end of the day, though, I mean, that's a lot of what it is. It's like you've got a generation that believes they earned that appreciation on their home. And in many ways, they feel like it's their legacy, to their children. And so they don't want to come down on prices. At the same time, you have generations who can't afford rent. And so, the Wall Street Journal did an interesting article last week too, talking about that even the upper part of the K, even they don't feel good about the economy. Even they don't feel like the system is working for them. And so, and the change from 2017, Andy, is just like anybody that didn't see that article, I would recommend it. It's just like, whoa. And so you've got a lot of really awful sentiment out there everywhere. And everybody wants to blame somebody. And but all sides have a point. But at the same time, prices are just going to have to come down or wages have to go up. It's just that simple,
Talk a little bit about the big institutional investors, the BlackRocks of the world that were buying up homes hand over fist for the last several years. They must really be in trouble here. And is it your expectation that a lot of these big institutional investors, people that were institutions that were buying these homes, as well as the banks that were financing them, I mean, we're going to have a problem with them, meaning I don't see them being very liquid. And does that also spawn into really another regional banking crisis, do you see, potentially?
Well, it could for sure. But, Blackstone, particularly, like they've been in trouble since 2022 and they've been doing everything they possibly can to hide it. They started gating their BREIT fund in 22. And they were just able to get enough cheap leverage by not marking their books down. So the banks were still giving them, loans based on collateral that was probably worth half of what they were saying, but they still got the loan, and that's all that mattered. But I talked to the biggest, one of the biggest ones out there in September of last year at a conference, and he said that as soon as leases are up, they are fire selling those things as quickly as possible. And so they're already selling, which is why Atlanta is seeing year-over-year price declines, because you have big motivated institutional sellers because Atlanta is one of the markets they really went into. And so everybody wants to talk about, I mean, I find it funny, so many narratives out there, and I personally believe the narrative around institutionals got out in the public space so they could provide some kind of bailout because, maybe they could be like, oh, I've got these 100 homes. If you give me a tax break, I'll give you these homes you can use in your affordable housing program, something like this, right? But yeah, they're already in serious trouble and they've been net sellers for a while. Only a few of them, when they have made trades, a lot of times, and this is what's so gross, is they'll sell them to one another and they won't market appropriately so that yet again, they don't have to recognize that they should be marking these assets much lower. And then on the commercial real estate side, oh boy, the regionals there, yeah, they are in trouble. And a lot of the regionals too got into private credit lending. And so this, we've just got so many risks across the system right now. Really anything could kind of start the fire, but it's likely going to start in private credit, in my opinion.
Talk a little bit about, and we just have a few more minutes, but talk a little bit about commercial real estate. And again, I only know Atlanta. It's just driving around Atlanta, I see these huge sky rises everywhere. And it doesn't seem like they're And I don't know, but it doesn't seem like they're full at
Oh
all.
no, they're not. I
So what's
mean,
going to happen with that?
bulldozers. I mean, that's I've been in so many of these downtowns. It is just so insane. Like the vacancy, and the denial about the vacancy is so we've been hearing about the commercial real estate debt maturity wall since 2022, and everybody's like, well, when's it gonna happen? Well, what people didn't realize about that debt maturity wall is that embedded in that were extension options. And so TREP actually tracks something called the hard debt maturity wall, which means these are the loans that have zero extension options left.
Oh,
And
gosh.
we have the largest debt maturity wall that we've had ever this year, hard debt maturity wall. And most of it's going to hit in Q3 and Q4. And it's not only office, it's multifamily, it's lodging, it's student housing, it's all of it. And so, the end of the year is looking to be really, 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 really not great. But yeah, commercial real estate, we're at some point, it's the same. We're going to have to deal with this problem. And it's a safety and soundness issue. You can see it all over the country, Dallas, Atlanta, Denver, where you have this massive vacancy. It's not feeling very safe. And so, you might even be building like in Dallas, it's so crazy, right next to an abandoned office tower where you can see baby strollers. You can see that people have been living there. They're building this spangly new tower right next door. But who wants to go into a tower when they're surrounded by an empty downtown where there's no food, there's no options, you don't feel safe and secure? So at some point, these cities are going to have to accept, and it's starting to happen because they got drunk off the American Rescue Plan money. That's all running out. And so most cities in the country now have a budget deficit. And so reality is coming home to roost. It has just taken a really long time.
A couple things about that. One, personally, I just got my tax. Property tax statement, and it showed my home value going down by about $30,000. And this is in
No
Atlanta.
way. Wow.
Which, in one sense, I was happy with, because my
Yeah.
taxes are, they should be down or going lower. But then I that's what really made me reach out to you, is like, wow, this is getting real here in Atlanta. But then another thing is, I'm just about to go meet with a friend who used to work for Goldman Sachs. He runs a private a boutique firm now, managing money and that sort of thing. And just their modules actually that he runs actually says exactly what you're saying. That it was eye-opening to me. He said, first quarter next year,
Yeah.
that's the slowdown. That's what he said. And it's what you just said, there's a buildup to housing that turns down, that affects the economy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So quite interesting.
It's a process, and I think we want it to be an event. But it's a process, and you have these waves of people. You have the first wave. The first wave peaced out in 23, you know. But it's the second, third, fourth. And private credit has really been fueling a lot of this lending. I mean, they're the ones that really lend to the Airbnb bros and things like that. And so, yeah, this is all going to unravel. It just takes time. But thank you for sharing that perspective. Most people think I'm crazy. So, you know.
No, I don't think you're crazy. Not only am I seeing it in my own life, but just talking to, again, a friend that I just have an enormous amount of respect and running his modules. And he's like, yep, it's right here, Andy. January and February, not good for the economy. We're going to see a huge slowdown there just with his models. Melody, I wish I had more time with you, but I'd love to. How can people read you? How can I believe? And I am a supporter of your.
Thank you.
How do people give us your website? How do people read you on Substack and that sort of thing?
Sure. You can see me on X Twitter at M3 underscore Melody, but then I also encourage everybody to sign up for at least the free version of the Substack because I put a ton of info in there. But that's M3 Melody Substack.
I'll put all of that in the show notes below on YouTube, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. Melody, I'll have you on anytime. I'd love to get you on as we further on, maybe for a little further on in the year, and just to see where we're at in this process.
Sounds good. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Melody.